Well, greetings everyone and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally and internationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 120 countries worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on the limited liability story when we come back. Hey, let me ask you this. What do you think is wrong with the Ten Commandments? Because it's pretty obvious that something is wrong with these Ten Commandments because they have been banned from our public schools, they're banned from our public institutions, and they've been banned from our national consciousness. Now, instead of these ten simple time-tested laws, we see the ten planks to the Communist Manifesto in their place. And they teach these ten planks to the Communist Manifesto in our public schools, our public institutions, and we've made them a part of our national psyche. Now, you know, this is a pretty radical change in our political and moral outlook over the past 50 years, don't you think? Are you aware, for instance, that your daughter couldn't receive an aspirin in your public school without your consent, but she can have an abortion arranged through that same public school nurse without even your knowledge, much less your consent? That's why I contend that the solution to this kind of moral perversion and national insanity is to go back to what worked. Let's go back to the Ten Commandments and the Mosaic Law. You know, our founding fathers practiced and advocated the Ten Commandments, and they even put 22 principles of that law into our federal constitution. And there's still at least one school left in America that's teaching this entire Mosaic Law, the Ten Commandments, and all 759 statutes, judgments, and commandments, as well as the penalties and the 33 benefits for their observance. Now, you know, every law has a penalty, and you don't have to know what the penalty is to suffer from its effect. So whether we call this the Mosaic Law, the Law of God, the Common Law, or Natural Law, or Karma, or something else, it's automatic, and it works just like AIDS, herpes, and VD, which just happens to be the natural penalty for adultery. Now, if you'd like more information, why don't you call and order our free General Law CD package? That's the place to start. It's a four-hour commentary on the law in general, and it's educational, and it's informative, it's entertaining, and best of all, it's free. And you can call right now. The number's 417-273-4967. Once more, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, if you're online, go to our website, georgegordon.org. Click onto the email machine and send us an email request for that free General Law CD package. Again, georgegordon.org. All right, we've been talking about limited liability and trying to figure out what our relationship to it is, and boy, it's quite a little story. There's a lot of legal connections that go along with insurance. That's what limited liability is. It's insurance. And as a result of that, when you buy into an insurance plan, you know, you buy a life insurance policy or something like fire insurance or something, there are some legal liabilities that you don't know much about. And last time we were taking a look at not only here's what it's all about, but here's who it affects. And here's the history of it. Here's the way it got started. And here's the way they sold it to us. So let's take a look at the evolution of the insurance policy as it relates to Joe Sixpack and Sally Housewife. So for the sake of our discussion, let's go into the boardroom, you know, a mythical boardroom of a fictitious insurance company, and we'll call them Rip 'em Off Incorporated. And let's listen in as the executives of the Rip 'em Off Insurance Company Incorporated discuss this Surrey wagon accident that we talked about in the last program. So the chairman of the board, Maurice Profitsmuch, calls the meeting to order, and he announces that the purpose of this meeting is to discuss ways to increase profits and cut costs. Now, the chair recognizes Albert Suckerman, and Albert begins by suggesting that the company go all out to sell collision, public liability, and property damage insurance to everyone who owns a motor vehicle. He points out that just selling insurance to business limits our sales. If we want to expand this business, we have to go to the general public. Profits could be staggering. It will increase sales and revenue, and therefore profits. But the question, gentlemen, is how can we convince the ordinary citizens to buy this kind of business insurance? Now, in the past, insurance has always been applied to risks in business, not to individuals. So for the answer to that question, let's examine a recent accident. There was a head-on collision last year between a wagon insured by Sucker-A-Day Insurance Company and an individual insured by our company. After the case was settled, the court found the individual who was driving the Surrey guilty of negligence, and he couldn't pay the damages. We will use this scare tactic with newspaper ads showing the artist's conception of the wreck and of the family farm being seized by the sheriff while his wife and children stand by crying as their home is violently taken away from them. It'll be dynamite. A new growth industry will develop within the insurance industry. Ordinary people will be lining up to buy insurance for their cars. The year 1900 will go down in history as the year of the auto insurance policy. And we all know that these vehicle accidents are so rare that we will hardly ever pay over a claim. Boys, I tell you, we'll make a killing. Mr. Profits Much takes a vote. Everyone is excited about the future of the auto insurance policy. Sales climb. Agents abound. And the public buys insurance to protect them from loss of their farms and property. And for only a small premium, they get all of this protection. Now let's go to 1910. There's a board meeting. And the chairman of the board, Mr. Profits Much, begins by saying, I've called this meeting to order to discuss ways for us to cut costs and increase profits. The chair recognizes Andrew W. Sawbucks. Andy? Sawbucks rises to speak and he addresses the board as follows. He says, our biggest problem with costs is our claims. Our losses to claims are staggering. We never dreamed that there would be so many automobiles and so many accidents. People are simply too reckless and careless. This is especially true of accidents that occur at intersections. I think what we need is a method to regulate traffic at the intersections. If we could force vehicles going one way, for example, east and west, to yield to vehicles going the other way, north and south, we could readily determine liability. I think what we need is a stop sign law. And here's how the stop sign law would work. We'll put up signs at busy intersections that say stop. If an accident occurs at this intersection, all we have to do is establish who is at fault by looking at who failed to stop. This will fix liability. It'll save money. We won't have to go through costly litigation. I propose that we send lobbyists to the various state legislatures to sell them on the idea of a system of traffic regulations, such as stop sign laws, driving on only one side of the road. We should be able to sell the idea because all accidents affect a public interest, and the regulation of traffic will make it safer for everyone on the highways. Now, we should proceed cautiously, but in the name of health, safety, and welfare of the people. This will at first seem like regulation and regimentation. And it may elicit a reactionary hostility by certain constitutionalists who will claim that these laws violate their rights. However, these regulations are slight, and the majority of people will go along with these ideas, especially in the cities. Initially, there will be resistance to applying these laws in the rural areas, but after a few generations, resistance will decrease. Besides, most people will accept these new rules, and they will not be enforced as law. These regulations will only be used as evidence in court to establish fault when a loss or damage occurs. Now, obviously, the board bought the plan, and it was set in motion. Soon, all of the states had driving laws. No mention of any loss of rights was mentioned. The insurance company has a large financial interest to protect, so the money that they spend is spent to make more money. Since there is no financial interest in rights, there is seldom any resistance to these new rules and regulations. In the early days, these rules were not enforced as criminal statutes with pains and penalties because there were common law protections, and it did not appear that anyone had lost his rights. When a loss or damage occurred, there was no loss of rights because the common law would simply use the statute as evidence to establish fault. It was later that we came to the expedient of charging money for fines when there were infractions or violations of these rules. Now, in 1920, there was a board meeting. A meeting of the board of directors is called, and the new chairman of the board is David Rockefeller, and he begins by saying, I've called this meeting to discuss ways for us to cut costs and increase profits. John Squeezumdry is recognized and rises to address the board. He said, our biggest problem is company jumpers and the repeated claims of some of our own policyholders who have numerous accidents. Both have limited liability for their debts through our coverage. They drive carelessly, and as a result, there are too many accidents. I think what we need is a record-keeping system among the companies. This would give us the ability to refuse to insure unsafe drivers. At the current time, if we cancel a person's policy, he simply goes to another company which has no knowledge of his poor driving ability. The cost of each company keeping such records is prohibitive. Therefore, we need statutory authority for each state to keep track of drivers and their ability to drive, or their lack of ability thereof. We want the taxpayers and government to pay for this record-keeping system. We need it for our internal use, but we don't want to pay for it. We need everyone who has a policy to have a license. And in that way, we will have at our disposal a person's driving record, which is kept by the state, paid for by the taxpayers, to each and every licensed driver, that will give us a ready record of his driving skills or abilities, and we can insure him or exclude him, and that will increase our profits. To accomplish this, we need some way to sell a licensing program to the states and to our policyholders. Selling our policyholders on the idea will be easy because we can simply offer lower rates for those who obtain a license and apply higher rates to those who do not. Now the states will be a little harder to sell. We need to sell them the idea of safety. Each should have a driver's education program to ensure that everyone who drives an automobile is competent to do so. Then the states can issue a license of competency. When they have tested those who have insurance policies, it should reduce our claims, as all policyholders will be educated to the same rules of the road. There may be some people who will complain about rights violations, but here again, no one should complain too much because of the financial savings to the insured. The states can claim that the purpose of this new law, this new statute, is to provide safety for the people as well as lower insurance rates. No one will lose any rights because the new statutes only apply to insurance policyholders, and policyholders will have agreed by contract to give up their rights, and they won't even realize it. Well, by 1930, there was a board meeting. Again, David Rocky Fuller begins by saying, "I've called this meeting to order to discuss ways for us to cut costs and increase profits." Now, the chair recognizes attorney shrewdness. Mr. Shrewdness arises and addresses the board. He says all drivers should be licensed to drive. There are too many cases where people drive cars without licenses and without insurance, and they have accidents with those of us who do, and our policyholders have insurance. This is causing a lot of expense in court time, and it is still difficult to get a settlement paid from the uninsured person. So what we need is a mandatory licensing law and insurance so that all persons can be treated the same. Besides that, if there is mandatory insurance, just think of the new policyholders that we will get. With so many new customers, we can reduce the cost even more. The state will keep records on drivers, suspend driving privileges, keep poor risks off the road, and give us the means to identify poor risks and charge them more in premiums. We may even come up with an assigned risk program for those bad drivers. That'll increase our profits even more. Another benefit is that all licensed drivers will be removed from their common law status to contract. They will no longer drive as a matter of right, but as a matter of privilege, under contract. And this will expedite court proceedings. There will no longer be a need to try traffic cases at law. Traffic cases can then be tried in summary proceedings, just like lawyers are tried in summary process when charged with misconduct or malpractice. Now, the board was ecstatic with this new mandatory insurance and licensing proposal. And they quickly approved the plan, and they sent their lobbyists into the legislatures, who promoted the new licensing laws to the people. And the people loved it because their insurance rates went down. And besides, having a driver's license became a lot like a status symbol. 1940, board meeting. The new chairman, Paul Warburger, called the meeting to order and began by saying that he called this meeting to order to cut costs and raise profits. A board member rises and says that he thinks we need stringent enforcement of the traffic laws. If people were harassed by a police force and made to pay a fine, a penalty, every time they broke one of the traffic rules, it should make them more careful, which should, in turn, reduce claims against the company and therefore increase profits. Besides, such a program should be easy to sell, especially in the states, as they will get revenue from all of these violations of the traffic code. We'll work it just like we work it in Maritime Admiralty. The states always need money, and their income from this source will be unlimited, as the more violations they cite, the more money they make. We can sell it as a self-supporting program to decrease traffic accidents, which will benefit the general welfare of the public at large. Statistically, when a driver breaks one of the rules, we know that it is three times more likely that he will have an accident, and our claims window is three times more vulnerable. So we need policemen out on the streets writing tickets and enforcing our traffic laws in the same way that they would enforce any other criminal law. We will make traffic violations a criminal offense. This will be popular with the people. We will tell them we're going to make the statutes and highways, or the streets and highways, safer for them. To sell the new law and order program, we will show the people the accidents that are particularly gruesome. Just like we do when we sell them an insurance policy in their living rooms. We will support prosecutors running for office on platforms of law and order. And soon, we will have the people obeying traffic laws just like any other law. They will fear punishment, and they will fear loss of property, and they will drive much more carefully. This will cut our claims, and it will increase our profits. Well, in 1950, there was a board meeting, and the new chairman of the board was Harold Stratison, and he called the meeting to order and said, "We need ways to cut costs and increase profits." So an old-timer on the board member, a lawyer, an ex-prosecutor, rises and begins by saying, "I think what we need is a streamlined court procedure for dealing with this enormous load of traffic crime. The courts are plugged up with enormous loads of cases. The people are angry with the slow process of their cases. A man can go to court, and then he's away from his job all day. If he pleads not guilty, the costs get way out of hand. What is even worse is that there are too many cases being thrown out of court or dismissed without a judicial determination, especially where a citizen or a citation was issued in a case where an accident has occurred. That just adds to the later costs of litigation. So we need an equity proceeding in executive police court chancery to adjudicate these traffic cases. And when executive summary proceedings are held, the time that it takes for each case can be reduced to seconds for guilty pleas and minutes for not guilty pleas. Trials need not be by jury in equity, but I think we should keep the jury process for good public relations sake. And on the surface, it will appear as if these are common law courts and common law juries. This will be popular with the people, popular with the courts, and very profitable, both for the claims window of our company and also for the taxing districts. Rights will not be an issue since there will not be any constitutional questions asked. Now that everyone has a driver's license, they all drive under privilege in equity instead of at law by right. This proposal will speed up justice, create more revenue, create more courts and more taxing districts. It will cut our costs. Our costs at our claims window will be cut and be popular with the people at the same time. The board was ecstatic and they approved overwhelmingly. Now in 1960, we need driver's education. A meeting of the board of directors was called and the new chairman of the board was John D. Doubletop. He calls the meeting to order and says, "I've called this meeting to discuss ways for us to cut costs and increase profits." A middle-aged man, an ex-school teacher, an educator, rises and says, "The automobile is no longer just a novelty or a toy. By now, it is a necessity. Our greatest losses at our claims windows today are now caused by the young drivers between the ages of 16 and 25 years. So I propose a propaganda campaign aimed at putting driver's education into every high school in the country as a mandatory subject on an equal footing with math, English, and civics. Here's how the program will cut costs and increase profits. In order for a young person to get a driver's license, he must enroll in a mandatory driver's education program. He must buy insurance and pass the courses. We will educate his young mind to the need for insurance, and at the same time, we will sign him up for the equity jurisdiction. We will, in short, have the perfect equity subject in total admiralty jurisdiction. Within a generation, no one will even bring up the subject of rights in a traffic court. We will teach him that to change lanes without signaling will cost him $40, and we'll call it a fine. The subject of corpus delicti, loss of life, liberty, and property at law will be an anachronism. The new equity man will always react to law in a positive way. When he breaks a rule, he will always plead guilty because he has been taught to know and fear the law and the rules. The citizen will always know when he is guilty. He will no longer have to be concerned with archaic old common law rules like intent, corpus delicti, victim, loss, property, or other complicated rules that cloud the facts. When he fails to register his car, the officer will give him a ticket, and he will know that he is guilty because the law tells him so. The best way for us to increase profits and cut costs is to educate and create our own customers from their youth. The board was wildly enthusiastic, and they adopted the educator's proposals. Now, in 1970, what we need are laws to ensure safer products. So a meeting of the board of directors is called, and the new chairman of the board is Ralph Nager. He calls the meeting to order and says, "I've called this meeting to discuss ways for us to increase profits and cut costs." A young man jumps to his feet and says that the losses suffered by our claims window can be traced directly to unsafe products. Some of these products are unsafe at any speed. Let me give you an example of these unsafe products that cost us profits and add to our claims losses. Take the seat belt, for example. When seat belts are used by passengers, our losses to claims are cut in half. So I propose that we push for consumer protection laws so that we can control the product that people buy. If we can control the product as well as the use of the product, it will cut our costs and increase our profits. Again, the board was ecstatic, and they approved the new proposal. Well, by 1980, we need mandatory insurance. So a meeting of the board was called, and the new chairman is John V. Eggers. He calls the meeting to order and says, "I've called this meeting to discuss ways for us to cut costs and increase profits." A young salesman, new to the board, addresses the group and says that, "Well, many people drive on our roads who are not insured. They drive an old car worth $100, and when they have an accident, they always hit a Porsche. Then, without any insurance, they can't pay the damages, and we end up paying for the Porsche. I think we need a law that requires every driver to carry insurance. This will not cut down on claims, but it will guarantee that every car is paying a premium, and that will increase sales. It will cut losses at the claims window, and it will increase profits. The people will love it because it will be more fair to the insured. They will reason that if they have to have insurance, why shouldn't everyone have insurance? The board was ecstatic and adopted the proposal. By 1990, the insurance industry came to the conclusion that we need to ban all hazards. So a meeting of the board of directors was called, and the new chairman of the board is Jimmy Cartier. And he calls the meeting to order and says, I've called this meeting to discuss ways for us to cut costs and increase profits. A dour, sober, old man rises, and he addresses the meeting. And very eloquently, by saying, for 90 years now, we have been addressing the problem of increasing profits and cutting costs to the insurance industry. Well, I've held my peace for the past 90 years, and I have listened to these proposals, and then I've watched them implemented. And now I have the ultimate solution for maximizing profits and limiting costs. It is very plain that insurance is for the health, safety, and welfare of the people. It's also very plain that we here in the insurance business are only interested in the security of the people and their happiness. And it's also very plain that we want to give them air without pollution, cars without accidents or injury, and eternal life. And for all of these blessings, we only want a very small premium. And for this small premium, we will grant you limited liability to remove you from any responsibility whatsoever for any and all of your actions. So today, I propose the ultimate insurance policy that will deliver to every policyholder 100% total protection from every possible hazard imaginable. I call it the padded cell policy. And it works like this. We go to the legislature and have them pass a law that requires every person, natural or artificial, to buy this policy just like we do with auto insurance. We then place the policyholder into a padded cell to protect him from falls, broken hips, and muggers. We put his car in storage so that he cannot be killed by a drunk driver. We close his factory to eliminate pollution. We take away from him all of his guns to ensure that no suicide or accidental shootings can take place. We filter all of the air into his cell to eliminate any and all pollutants. We prepare his food to eliminate cholesterol, sugar, white flour, and other harmful products that could make him sick, which could make him very unhappy. We keep the policyholder away from any power tools or hobby crafts. This will prevent home accidents. Only sponge baths will be allowed to prevent falling in the bathtub. No more rides on airplanes to prevent death in airplane crashes. We will allow no alcohol or any other dangerous drugs, no cigarettes. This will prevent lung cancer. In short, gentlemen, we will eliminate every single possible hazard from our policyholders. We will collect the premiums and we will pay out nothing in claims. The people will love it because they're getting full coverage and limited liability and total security. No rights are involved because the policyholder is reduced from status to contract. He's now declared incompetent. We cannot lose because there will be no claims. Now all we have to do is determine the premiums. And the board was ecstatic and adopted the policy. Now, boys and girls, the state imposed upon the Polish people, the Russian people, and the Chinese people by force in 1945. And it's no different than the police state that we Americans have imposed upon ourselves today. But there is one huge glaring difference in the adoption of these two systems. You see, we paid to have our rights subjugated to limited liability by contract. Now, the Poles, the Russians, and the Chinese saved them a lot of money. And we Americans still have our Constitution, and we can reject this limited liability and perpetual credit debt slavery and feudal tenure whenever we want to accept responsibility for our own actions and our own debts. The Poles, the Russians, and the Chinese cannot. There are not many people who want to trade their slavery for the rigors of the life of a free man. But for those few men and a few women who want to be free, there is a school, it's called Barrister's Inn, to teach anyone who wants to be free how to be free. Now, not everyone in America registers his car with his government. Not every man or woman in America asks for government permission to drive or has a license to drive. 22 million Americans don't pay income tax. There are even some free men who don't pay personal or real property taxes. The flame of freedom is involved, and every person who wants to be free can be free and he can free himself, but no one else can free him. Redress of grievance comes on the courtroom floor, not in a political rally, not in a union meeting. It doesn't come from writing a letter to the editor. The courtrooms are open, and they're manned by knowledgeable jurists who will listen to and rule in favor of any man who has natural inalienable rights if he knows how to claim them. Or that same jurist can slam the door on a slave in limited liability and leave him in his security. Now, there is no security in freedom, only boundless opportunity. There are thousands of freemen in America, not millions. The masses of people like security. They want welfare. They need limited liability. But to claim your rights, you must be compelled to defend your rights on the courtroom floor. Now, that's an article called Limited Liability. Limited Liability. Hey, I'm running a little over time. Let me give you a reminder here that you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review. We're sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law School the Law Hour, rather, is heard 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. If you'd like more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. Now, the Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from a scriptural perspective. Now, that's 8 schools in all. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals but by prearrangement. The Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc, and the Law Hour website is updated weekly, and it has our radio log schedule and archives, and all of it can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org. Now, all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. The Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours by calling the Law School at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief, and the Law Hour and editorial review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program, and we often endorse or recommend books, papers, periodicals, and newsletters to our listeners. These endorsements or recommendations that we give don't mean that the authors or publications that we're endorsing will necessarily reciprocate. Keep in mind that most of these authors and publications cited here on the Law Hour may be hostile, political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans whose viewpoint may not be totally endorsed by the Law Hour and editorial review either. Now, these opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine. They're mine alone. They don't necessarily represent the views, beliefs, or the opinions of the advertisers, the sponsors, the management, or the staff of this radio network or of this local radio station. So if you'd like more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, then please go to our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org, or you can call us direct at 417-273-4967. All right, let's get down to where the rubber meets the road and down to the chase, and let me tell you a little story. There was a lawyer one time who bought, I think it was a big box, I forgot now, it was a big box of Havana cigars. It cost him $5 a cigar. It seems to me that the box had 100 cigars, and it was $500 for this box of cigars. And he smoked one of these cigars every day, and over a period of a couple of years, he consumed the entire box of cigars. Now, he noted in his homeowner's policy that the homeowner's policy would pay for damages and fires that caused a damage to his property. So, after having carefully read the terms and conditions of his homeowner's policy, he put in a claim, and he claimed that he lost his 100 cigars for a total of $500 in a fire, and that the cigars had been consumed in the fire, and that under the terms and conditions of the policy, he was entitled to payment. He submitted his claim to the insurance company, and the insurance company was outraged. They were outraged because when they were asked what caused the damage, and he said a match, and who struck the match, and he said he did. And they said, well, why did you strike the match? It's so that I could light the cigar. Well, why then did you deliberately burn your cigar? And he said, yes, I did. And they said, well, then you're the proximate cause of your own injury. We're not going to pay you for smoking your cigars. And they denied his claim. So he sued, and he went into court, and he presented his case, and he presented the contract. And when he got through presenting the contract, the judge decided in favor of the lawyer. The terms and conditions of the contract provided that the insurance company would indemnify the policyholder for the destruction of his property in the event it was destroyed by fire. The lawyer came in and showed that this was a part of his homeowner's policy. The cigars were located in his home. They were, in fact, destroyed by fire, and the insurance company had to pay. So the insurance company, reluctantly, but they did pay. They wrote out the check for the $500 and presented it to the lawyer. The lawyer duly endorsed the back of the check and deposited it in his bank, whereupon the insurance company filed a criminal complaint against the lawyer for arson, for having deliberately destroyed his property, whereupon he was arrested, and he was prosecuted for arson. And since the amount was more than $150, it amounted to a felony. He was convicted, and he was jailed for 5 years. Lost his license and can never practice law again. Which just goes to show you that time and chance happens to us all. Even to a lawyer. Thought you'd like that. It doesn't happen often, but once in a while, justice does prevail. Now let me point out to you what's going on in the insurance industry and why it is that the insurance industry runs roughshod over all of us. The first thing that we need to understand is that the insurance company writes the policy. They put into the policy those provisions that they want to benefit the insurance company. They leave out those provisions that would benefit or cost them more money if that benefit was written into the policy. Furthermore, they have the opportunity and the expertise to write the provisions of the policy in the language that they want to use and that they want to show. Not the language that you want or the language that you want to show. They write it. You have no input into this whatsoever. This is the purest form of adhesion contract known to man. It's the insurance policy. Then, the insurance industry goes to the legislature and they lobby for a law that requires you to buy their product against your will and over your objection. You must buy their product or it is a criminal act for which you will be punished criminally for not buying their product. We don't have that with automobiles, television sets, or carpet yet. Boys and girls, if the insurance industry can compel you to buy insurance, the same legislature using the same police powers can compel you to buy television sets or carpet or automobiles. Now, in addition to this, the insurance industry controls the agenda. They go into the legislature and they write the rules by which any controversy will be decided. They actually write the rules of court. And we saw this with the Dick Armey case, in which he wrote into the law that if you're damaged by vaccines, you cannot sue the vaccine maker. Isn't that special? Let's try it this way. If you're driving a Ford automobile and you have an accident, and this accident shows that the Ford Motor Company was negligent in the manufacture of the automobile which caused you your injury, you cannot sue the Ford Motor Company because by law they have been exempted from lawsuits by owners of Ford automobiles. We have a law like that already. Let me show you how that one works. Up in Fairbanks, Alaska, there's a requirement by the Fairbanks Light and Power Company that you buy, it's a cooperative, that you buy one share of stock, at least one share of stock, in the co-op in order to get electric service. Why does the co-op want you to buy one share of stock? Well, because a stockholder cannot sue a company that he holds stock in if he's claiming a damage. Isn't that special? Now, these laws are written by these industries to benefit these industries. Now, as I speak, down in the Gulf, there's a big oil spill. And the president came out the other day, and he said, well, by God, we're going to have BP. They're responsible for this, and they're going to pay for all this cleanup. Boys and girls, I don't believe that British Petroleum has enough resources to pay for all that cleanup. I'll be amazed. So that means that BP would have to declare bankruptcy because they simply don't have the funds with which to do it. But it's better than that. Better than that. Congress has already written the law. They've already written the legislation. BP cannot be held liable for more, I believe the number is $75 billion. That's the max. Now, I fully believe that BP has $75 billion. In fact, I would suggest that $75 billion is probably pocket change to British Petroleum. They probably keep that in the petty cash drawer. They will pay the $75 billion, but the taxpayers of America are going to pay for that cleanup. That's the law. That's the way the game's played. Now, for political mileage, the president's out here telling you, oh, BP is going to pay for this. Excuse me, boys and girls. You go down and get a vaccination and die from it, then you go ahead and sue Merck. but your case is going to be thrown out of court. You cannot sue Merck for bad vaccine, period, end of report. Now, to show you ignorance on a grander scale, there was a fellow by the name of Oliver North. He was a public official. I believe he was a Marine. He worked in the Reagan administration in the 1980s, and they had a scandal come up. It was called the Iran-Contra scandal. Well, there was some wrongdoing and some skullduggery going on, and one day Oliver North was brought in before Congress. And Ollie came in, testified, and they said, hey, there's some things that we'd like you to tell us. And he said, well, if you want me to tell you those things, you got to give me immunity from prosecution. And so the Congress molded over a little bit, and they came back one day, and they said, well, we see the wisdom in your argument. We're going to give you this immunity from prosecution. So Oliver North came in, and he said, okay, well, let me tell you the answer to the riddle. So he told Congress the answer to the riddle, and that implicated him in some of the skullduggery that was going on. And so the Justice Department said, well, now that Oliver North came into Congress, and he has confessed, and he has given us this information, we're going to go ahead and prosecute him for this crime, or crimes. I forgot how many there were, probably 10, something like that. They usually stack charges on people if they possibly can, so they did, and they prosecuted this guy. Now, Oliver North, after this trial was over, he complained bitterly that he spent $500,000 on his defense. He went out and hired a law firm, and the law firm tried his case, and when the jury came back, they found him guilty as hell. He said, hey, this guy North is just flat-ass guilty, and we find him guilty. And so Oliver North took his case up on appeal. And when it got into the Court of Appeals, I think it was done right there in Washington, D.C., if I remember. I took it to the First Circuit or Second Circuit Court of Appeals, and they overturned his conviction. Now, you'd think maybe the law firm over there would have pled his case a little differently, but they walked in, and he pled not guilty, and they argued his case and lost it. The pleadings were faulty. Pleadings were faulty. He only had one defense. Factually, he did what it was that he was charged with. But you see, Congress gave him immunity, and the Fifth Amendment protected him from testifying against himself. He exercised that right, and he exercised it timely. And then the prosecution came against him, and they charged him with this crime. You can't do that, but they did it. So his correct pleading was immunity. I have been granted immunity. You can't prosecute me. Immunity, immunity. It's the only defense he had. He didn't need a law firm. He didn't need anybody. He can walk in there and say, immunity. I got immunity. I got immunity. I got immunity. That's all he had to say. I got immunity. Never had to spend a dime on a lawyer. And the prosecution would have convicted him, and he would have went into the appeals court, and he would have said, immunity, immunity, immunity. And the appeals court would have reversed his conviction, which is precisely the correct pleading and precisely the correct outcome in the case. And it would have saved him $500,000. But he didn't know. And he went out and spent the $500,000, and sure enough, when it was all said and done, he lost his case, and then he had to go to appeal. Well, hell, anybody could have done that, you know, if they would have simply known what it was they needed to do. Now, that's a pretty high-profile case, and I can readily understand why a Marine probably would not know very much about law, but can you see how important a legal education is? You don't have to be very smart. When I first saw that, I said, well, I can't believe that they've brought this guy to trial. You know, I don't go to Washington and sit there and watch all this or read all the pleadings, but I saw it in the paper, and I said at the time, didn't Congress give him immunity? Seems to me that he got immunity when he testified before Congress. You can't bring him to trial. He's already been given immunity. And sure enough, there he was, brought to trial. And so people asked me, hey, what's going on here? I said, I don't know. I haven't got a clue. The guy went in there, pled not guilty. He's in there just defending himself up one side and down the other. The only defense he's got is immunity. He's guilty as hell. He did all those factual things. And then they found him guilty, and I said, well, that's kind of crazy. How could a guy that got immunity be prosecuted? Well, pretty soon he went up on appeal, and he reversed his conviction. I said, ah, there it is. He had bad pleadings that went into the case. His lawyer double-crossed him is what happened. Now, remember I told you here last time or time before, you know, that lawyers are entrepreneurs. Nice guys. I don't deny it, but, you know, they're entrepreneurs. And if you walk into a lawyer and you say to him, now, here's my side of the case, and here's what I want, the lawyer is going to say, well, just put your money where your mouth is there, son. You got a wonderful case, and I'll take it in and present it for you. And he will. Then he'll probably lose. At least he'll lose 94% of the time. That's the statistical average. Now, if that lawyer was honest and told you the truth and said, you don't have a case here, son, and your case is going to be lost if you take it up that way, then you wouldn't hire him. You would go to another lawyer. You would go to the lawyer that would tell you what you want to hear. I told you that the other day. there was a guy came to my office and he said, I'm with the defense committee of the Murray, Utah policeman with three wives who's relying upon religious free exercise. And after I looked at the factual part of his case and I looked at the legal part of his case, I put the two together and I said, son, you can't get there from here. The guy's guilty, and the best thing you can do is plead guilty, go to the prosecution and say, hey, look, I made a mistake. I'm sorry as hell. We'll stop doing it. And he didn't do that. His case is written up. I just saw it the other day for some reason. We were looking this up. It's right there next to Reynolds in polygamy. Just take a look at polygamy and find law, and it'll tell you, Murray, Utah policeman with three wives, lost his case. Now, I'm not opposed to the guy having three wives, and I'm not opposed to him being a policeman, and I'm not opposed to religious free exercise. I'm in favor of all of the above. But you can't practice polygamy with a marriage license. If you're going to practice polygamy, boys and girls, you've got to do it without a marriage license. Once you enter into a regulated enterprise, then you're going to be regulated and controlled. And that's all we're dealing with here. We have been induced into joining into these regulatory programs. And as a result of that, we're being regulated and controlled by the nanny state. And then as a result of that, you're complaining and you're saying, hey, what happened to my rights and freedoms? You signed them away at the Army recruiter's office when you signed up for the Army. When you signed your enlistment contract, you left your Bill of Rights in the dust. When you signed up for your driver's license, you left your rights in the dust. When you got your marriage license, business license, Social Security number, and your all these goodies that you wanted with this security blanket that's been wrapped around you, you have waived your rights for these benefits. As George Bush used to call it, the safety net. You want the safety net? You got it. So if you like the safety net, stick with the program because you've got a winner. If you don't like the safety net, well, then you need to make some changes. All right, we're out of time. I got to give you a final reminder here that you have been listening to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. We're sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States. We're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. If you'd like more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. Now, the Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals but by prearrangement. The Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults and compact desk, and the Law Hour website is updated weekly, and it has a radio log schedule and archives. All of it can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Time's up. We've got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station, God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.